And also a little bit sort of everywhere at the same time kind of thing. I just read Elizabeth Gilbert, you know, this Eat, Pray, Love woman. Do you know her? Yes?
I
Yeah.
watched the movie, but I haven't read the book.
No, me neither. The same. But I borrowed a book from the library by her called Big Magic: Living Creatively Without Fear, Beyond Fear, or something. Yes, and after about 40 pages or something, it was very, very good. And I read the whole thing in one day, which is it just tells you something about how generously it was spaced and how easily it was written, because otherwise I don't read that fast when I have a baby. But it was very good. And she said that the world is populated by people and ideas, and that ideas don't have a body per se, of course, but the only thing they want is to be made manifest, and they will be looking for someone who are as stubborn as they are. Isn't it nice?
Oh, I love
I
that.
know.
Wow. Oh, I'm feeling that so much. Yeah, because it's even, this sort of idea, this kind of concept of everything being a person in a sense. Not that everything is a human, but I guess the way we relate with others. And I kind of feel like ideas are a person in a way. That's kind of where I'm going with it. Maybe in a similar way, like a tree is or a flower. Or, I guess, I mean, even like a bug or something. It's sort of, yeah,
An
I
entity
agree
that you
with
can have
you.
like a dignified relationship with, where you both are dignified, both you and
I almost feel like ideas are sort of like that too, They're sort of an extension of ourselves, I think, and of, if everything's interconnected and we all exist together, then who's to say that an idea isn't like an ex, you know, just an extension of all that is in a sense.
Or even its own thing that's its own yeah it was a lovely, lovely part of that book that she just she really meant it. You could really feel that she meant it. The ideas populate the world. They want to be made manifest. It's the only thing they want. Yeah, and they come to you and knock on your door, and you can say, yes, I'll do it. I'll be your partner in your manifestation, sort of.
I should perhaps explain what's happening here. This is a conversation that I am having with Jay, my very first conversation with Jay, in fact. And we had decided several weeks ago that we wanted to do something, some sort of project. So we said we'd meet. And then in the weeks and days leading up to the date we'd set, we were thinking of what to talk about and what to do. And this Hawkins scale of consciousness, or Hawkins table of the levels of consciousness, came up. But since it was the first conversation ever, we started there. But right, what follows now is a conversation that is mainly, but not exclusively, about Dr. Hawkins' table of the levels of consciousness. And these little sniffly sounds that you hear, they're my baby. Why should she be kept quiet? She's allowed to be around.
Do you want to see what happens if we try to talk about Hawkins' scale of consciousness?
Oh yeah, those are I'm like yes. Sorry. I actually those were like I had two little notes written about him as well. I think quantum mechanics says we need to look at lived experiences more and consciousness-radical subjectivity, which I think is sort of some... He mentions it in somewhere that I read about the I being the, like, the only I that is the I of radical subjectivity.
What's radical subjectivity? Like, subjective, radical, in the sense that you have removed your, removed the ego kind of thing?
It's sort of, well, I feel like it's what one experiences as who they are, like their lived experience.
Oh, yes.
Entirely. Mm. So coming entirely from the I place in every moment, in a sense. Like, you know how there's sort of that communication tool, or, you know, and I think it's an aspect of nonviolent communication as well to use I instead of you, like, in, you know.
Yeah.
And so I kind of feel like it's almost a, like, deeper root of that, in a sense, of that, you know, in each moment to remember that everyone has this radical, radical subjectivity, yeah, that they're experiencing the world just as them inside. Like, they have, I almost see it as, like, everything has an internal world, in a sense. Because I think we only feel what we feel or think what we think is valuable, or, you know, care about the things we care about or experience being cared, you know, all these things, because we have this internal world experience of it all.
Yes. Yeah. I was, the reason I asked that way is because in the scale, he also has this, like, the highest form of, like, when he talks about the ego versus the self, and there's an insight that the self is God. So with that in mind, the way I see what he means by radical subjectivity is includes this realization, kind of. But it's do you see what I mean?
Yes. It's sort of, yes, like what we tend to believe is sometimes outside of ourselves is actually part of ourselves, in a sense.
That there is still the divine matrix, where we have a kind of position, because we speak from a position. I'm thinking the biblical idea that when God calls your name, what you answer is "Hinei," in Hebrew, which means "I am here."
Yeah.
It points at position, but it also, so your position is your radical subjectivity in this matrix, which is God.
So in a way, it's sort of like an "I am here" way of living.
Yeah, this is my here, or something like that. This yes, because the when you see it as a position, I mean, in the broad sense, obviously, it's quite clear that we are not, we never have two people who are the same, speaking from the same place. So using the word position and asking, God asks, "Where are you? Where are you, Abraham? Where are you?" And he says, "Hineni, I am here. I have hidden, but now I am here. Now I am showing my face." So the radical
subjective. I'm just, are you, it's a bit bothering me that I can't see what you look like when you're silent. And I was thinking about it myself when I was silent earlier, because, but I was just listening. So maybe you were just listening too.
Yeah, I know actually exactly what you mean. Because it's like, what am I, is anything I'm saying, like, what's happening here?
Yeah, what's happening and, to the words? And it's, I left them alone on this too long leash. Should I bring them back in somehow?
It's like walking around the block and not seeing your house anymore kind of thing. Or something. I don't know. But yeah, no, I was really enjoying that and just listening and kind of, letting it, you know, experiencing your words and what you were saying, and that's where I was at. So yeah, I'm very present right now, this moment, I think.
Yeah.
<No.
laughs> Yeah, who knows? I know. Okay. Oh, I sent you these three pictures that I just found. I'm pretending that we're starting the podcast now, and this is how I would do it. I'm just telling you, okay, we're starting in after the sentence. So I'm just saying that, I'm going to talk as if I'm talking to dear friends who just haven't heard about this scale of consciousness thing. So okay. So this is my audience. You know, you should, or they say that you should imagine an audience. So this is my audience. Good friends who like me and who have patience with me, and who are interested in this, or who you know, I'm going to see, make them see how that it is interesting, just by being interested myself. Never mind. Okay, so let's. So.
Oh yeah, no, I totally feel that. It's infectious. It's, yeah.
Okay. good. So Hawkins' scale of consciousness. This was brought up for the first time when I took this intergifted course, gifted psychology for coaches with Jennifer. And I looked at the table, and I sent you these three pictures. So let's look at like the one I saw there was the last one, the one with map of consciousness, God view, life view, level, log, emotion, process. So God view means the way you view ultimate authority. So when you see, for instance, in the level fear, you would have punitive, frightening, punitive God and a frightening life view. So even if you don't believe in God, obviously, it's just the things beyond your control and stuff like that, how you would see this. In Sweden, most people don't believe in God. And they would look at this and say, okay, I'm just going to not eradicate that column, but it's very important, this one.
Something just really clicked.
Yeah.
It's not what we're really looking at here is not whether, you know, there is a God or not in terms of like the biblical sense necessarily. Mm-hmm. It's more of just saying that an aspect of human behavior and what really impacts us is how we view God or that kind of role in our lives, in a sense.
That things that happen to you, like, you know, when you miss the bus or you have the sense of being punished or something. Why does this always happen to me? Hmm. Again, so the forces at hand kind of thing. A lot of people say they don't believe in God, but they behave as though they live in a world where there is a punitive God.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah, that's
it's
the whole,
interesting
like,
and important.
Religion.
Yeah. Sorry, what did you say?
Interesting and important. I agree.
Yeah.
Yes. I said that it's sort of like Well, I was really religious in high school for a few years, and I'm still sort of deprogramming from some of it. But there was definitely the first, right after I stopped being religious, the first few years was like, it was like this idea that now I no longer have a reason to be alive if I'm not following those laws or rules or, you know, kind of way of life, that, you know, that would sort of make my life a waste is sort of how, you know, the idea was afterwards. And it took a while to deprogram from, but, and I guess there's probably still stuff I'm not aware of or working, you know, or it, as I learn more, it kind of comes up. But yeah, that's kind of what I feel like, even this is funny because this is kind of, I kind of like Hawkins in one regard where he like, in one of his books, he writes, like at the end, this book on average tends to raise people's consciousness level like 35 points or something. And I was like, it's kind of, it's just, it, I thought it was kind of funny. Sorry, I like to zoom, like I really enjoy the, like getting a feel for authors sometimes, or their like, maybe their sense of humor in a way, or they're kind of like, I don't know how to even explain where I'm going with this. It's kind of a feeling. Sorry, I got a little bit distracted or kind of pulled away here.
This is very interesting. I wanted to ask you what you think about the level you were at just after this, because you have this apathy level there where the life view is kind of hopeless or like, what do I do now? It's also this, I wanted to bring in a Dabrowski, like Dabrowski level two, sort of whatever I do now, it's equally bad. There's no way out. Yeah. You know, I look left and right and I could try this or that, but it's all just the same bad. Yeah. How it was the dismay? It says despair on that emotion, but that's the first thing, thread that I wanted to pull a little. And then I thought, when you got a sense of the Hawkins sense of humor, you said, so did I understand you correctly? He said that by reading the book, you would raise your level by 35 points.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He said on average.
It's very funny. Also in the book that I'm reading now, which is called Transcending the Levels of Consciousness, it's possibly the Stairway to Enlightenment. So this comes much later from the other books that he wrote. Yes. And it says here in the foreword that it draws on the work from the previous books, but it's more of a sort of a guide, self-help guide. So to how to transcend the levels. So now I'm only in the beginning. So I'm reading about the second level, guilt. I've just finished shame. So now I'm on guilt. It's not a nice read. I mean, I have been there, you know, but I'm looking forward to coming levels. But the same, when I first looked at this table, I had the same sense of the humorousness in all these very high levels that he knows exactly what the emotion is and the process and the, you know, it's very funny. How did he find out and put it there? But let's just, that aside, I also showed this to a friend, a psychologist friend who I really like a very clever guy. And I'm like, so I've been looking at this Hawkins scale of consciousness and he goes, oh, wow. 500, logging 500. Wow, that's a lot. 600. Ooh, 700. Wow. You know, and it's, when you put it that way, of course, everyone's laughing. But but the way I like to tackle these
systems of thought, and these theories is by suspension of disbelief. Is that a phrase that you use? No, it's in English.
But I love it.
Yeah, it's in English, but it seems to be used much more by Swedish people. it sort of means that you will. It's the function that allows you to watch a cartoon or a science fiction movie and just buy the rules of the game. So you're not looking at it going like, what? I mean, those are mice. They can't wear clothes. They don't wear clothes. How could they even make those clothes? They can't hold a needle. They don't have thumbs. You know, like this idiot way of watching a cartoon, thinking it doesn't, it's totally unbelievable. You know, suspension of disbelief means that you buy the rules of the universe that you're in at the moment, and then afterwards you can go and talk about what you've seen. So what I want to do with this scale of consciousness for this program, this conversation that we're having now, and maybe other ones later, is to just for an hour we will accept the rules of this scale and discuss what it would mean for it to be like this, you know? What can we get from seeing levels of consciousness like this?
That's so cool. Yeah, no, that's... Sorry.
It goes, introduction.
The all-pervasive universal energy field called consciousness is of infinite power and dimension beyond time and is compositionally non-linear. It is the light of the world as it emanates from the unmanifest to the manifest, from the non-linear infinite potentiality to its linear expression as the unfolding of creation, the circumscribed perceived physical domain.
These are the two first sentences in this book. It's sort of...
Wow.
I know.
So beautiful.
Yes. Ah. And the rest of the book is like this too. I read every word of it.
Yes. Oh, this reminds me of the author Paulo Coelho. He has a similar style of writing where it's like somehow he is able to funnel down and find... It's almost like the sentences he has are like the bare, like the roots of what, how to explain it. It's like, it's like leaving it. It's like those books that you can read at different times of your life that kind of will always apply. Maybe it's like somewhat, I don't know. Actually, I don't know if that's not where.
I feel that I know what you mean, but I also don't know really how to say it. But the way I looked at these words was, this is like a lifetime of accumulated wisdom. He has perfected there's no word too many. They're in perfect order, perfect amount, perfect order. I mean, it's a fabulous read.
Yes, because he's sort of showing what he's talking about through the way he writes. It's almost like a walk and a talk. And I think, well, the first book I read of his was Letting Go. And in there, he does talk about his story a bit, like how he sort of, I think it was sort of his experience at each level. And it was interesting because it also had Dabrowski themes in there.
Mm.
Like there were times that he described being in just like pure emotional agony, maybe even physical to some degree as well. And as he was sort of, well, yeah, I like how I'm starting just like he was in pure emotional agony. Like that's it. That's the story. But he, as he was sort of, I think, you know, growing in these levels, which even the words for that are kind of the way they sound and the way that I think he describes or means them in a way doesn't like, I don't know, levels is very like kind of formal and technical. And I think he
and very, linear
very much talks about life. Yes, and linear. And he talks, I think those words don't quite always capture the beauty sometimes of what he, like talking about his map sometimes doesn't quite capture the beauty of it with the certain words that we have, I think. Or maybe because some of it is kind of, it to a degree, wordless and mysterious and sort of, there's that aspect maybe of its beauty.
Yes, I agree. And there's another quite major objection from a philosopher's point of view, and that's that he is talking quite a bit like an oracle. He's just stating how it is. He isn't giving reasons. But when I'm reading this book, I am allowing that. I'm allowing it. You know, I want to hear what this person has to say. I want to read his universe, just like I want to read many people's universes, and many. I want to engulf. I want to like devour. I want to like swallow them and process them. So I don't care at the moment that he makes this. It's like for a philosopher, it's a huge error. You have to always give reasons for what you're saying and explain all the new terminology that you bring about. And he can explain but by means of his own theory, you know. And he will say, yeah. So it doesn't. Never mind. I'm just saying. I am aware of this.
I'm sorry I interrupted you there. I got so excited.
Go ahead. Yes, sorry. I interrupt you sorry. Much more.
Oh, it's just so cool. I'm happy. And the thought just kind of floated away. It'll come back. Come back, thought, please.
It was the, okay. I want to eat it. I'm aware that he is.
Yes. I think, that is part of why I really enjoy philosophy in general, is just allowing and really any, like, well, yeah, I guess with philosophy, just letting that, I think philosophers, I think a part of why people have continued to be interested in philosophy, like why this is part of, you know, humanity in a sense, part of, you know, what we, our history and what we're, you know, looking at now is this, like, the feeling sometimes that a philosopher can, like, well, I don't know, maybe it's not that, I'm kind of mixing my subjective and objective stuff here, but but it's sort of like this feeling of looking at something differently, or sort of like this, like, I don't know, if I'm thinking of, like, if someone were to draw something and it looked one way, and then you turn the paper a different direction, and it could be something else, or the way you can look at a cloud, and it can be a bunch of different things. Mm-hmm. And each thing isn't necessarily less or more even real or valid. It's more of our sort of, like, we're taking it in where we're at right now in our sort of radical subjectivity, in our I, or as he talks about, our sort of our lived internal experiences, and each person's is different. And this one, and it's sort of, I think philosophers can kind of like, well, it's sort of, Hawkins really screws up my mind sometimes. This is like, I really feel myself trying to talk about it and realizing things about everything while doing that. They're sort of about my way of language and communicating. And so it's sort of happening right in this moment, almost this like shit. Just talking about it. It's kind of, yeah, I'm going to, I'm like passing the mic is what I'm doing.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. But this is what I'm thinking when I'm hearing you talk is to bring back the radical subjectivity versus, or not versus, but, you know, radical subjectivity and the both andness of radical subjectivity and self is God one. Thing. So asking the question, what are you seeing, is always a possibility. It's always interesting to ask the person next to you, the one you're walking with right now, you know, your medvandrare, with walker. You can always to ask this question, what are you seeing, is always interesting. And this is why, because of radical subjectivity, because we have a point of view. Again, this is positioning, right? The point of view. It means position. It points to a position, and position also points to relational aspects, because you're never alone in a vacuum. A position is always in relation to other places. Other points in the matrix. Whether when I say matrix, it's sort of it feels like I'm talking about a flat thing, like a flat sheet. But that's not what I mean. I mean
I saw it as pretty multidimensional in when you said that.
Okay, good.
In my head.
Good.
Yeah.
I started ages ago, I started talking about how I first heard of this scale of consciousness, and a little bit of my reactions, and how I showed it to a friend, and then suddenly again, about 2 weeks ago, I went to the gym, which I like these days, and I am an intuitive YouTube listener when I'm in the gym. So suddenly this YouTube video with someone called Krista something came up, and this will tell you something about what I usually listen to on YouTube. But it was something about changing your vibration or consciousness, or, you know, ascension or something like that. But it was just this woman on a stage, and she brought up the map of consciousness. And her point was, When you climb, or sort of when you ascend this, when you can log higher numbers, or I don't know how to put that, but when you get higher up in the levels towards enlightenment, you can influence other people much more. So at the lower ends, there's almost no influencing other people. Obviously, if we come across someone who is at this shame or guilt level,
You will notice, but you won't be smitten. It's not like you will immediately be drawn back to it, although it can sort of, it can, you might have these internal mirrors that will say, I know, I remember, you know, and sort of like a game, it will sort of respond and throw back and say, you know what I'm saying? If you meet someone at this level, they will, there might be points within you that are answer to their energy.
But if you, her point was that if you ascend, you can influence
a lot of people. So I figured, okay, I want to get enlightened. I want to reach enlightenment. I mean, who wouldn't, you know? So finding a book, and when I was Googling him, finding a book called Transcending the Levels of Consciousness, it was just like, I just looked at the title and I'm like, okay, so that one, click. And then I ordered it. I'm also an intuitive book buyer. yes. But after this show, I was walking around in the cold, wintry Göteborg, Gothenburg, with the baby. And I was thinking about the places I was going past. I was thinking, okay, I'm quite close to this cafe in this park. And I'm like, oh, no, but I don't feel like going there. Why not? Oh, because it's on the
pride level.
That's why. That's why I don't like being there. It's like a cafe on the pride level, meaning, of course, the sort of atmosphere among the staff.
Mm.
That's why I don't like it. And I was thinking about the TV show Ink Master. Have you seen that? It's been a million.
Is it about tattoos?
Yes, it's about tattoos. And there's been several seasons and many, many episodes. But often when you turn it on, they have close-ups of very angry, resentful faces of the competitors within the program. And they always hate each other. They always look into the camera and they go like, stupid, awful way. You know, she ain't gonna. I just hate it. And every time that show is on in my home, I just go, this is, it's bad for us to watch this. It's not good. We shouldn't watch this. You know? So I turn it off. Not to say that, you know, it was also on the other day and it was quite nice. It was a final and this, you know, so I don't want this conversation to be about trashing a good show. But this is certainly what I was thinking. So that's how I got into this scale of consciousness again, you know, for this. And that's why I told you about it. And then you said that you just read two books by him. Yeah,
I know. I think I get what you mean in terms of like what, like if you're, you know, you're walking around the world and you are at a certain consciousness level in each moment, and I think, you know, would it be fair to say that depending on where you're at and sort of what's around you, is it that you're more likely to go towards what you're already, you know, well, I guess that's sort of the reflection part, right? Like, is that kind of, I guess if humans lean towards wanting to be mirrored by others and wanting connection, then it kind of makes sense that they might go towards like what they, like, they'll see, maybe it makes sense that they'll find what mirrors those parts in them.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And this is, you know, since forever, people have said, go out in nature. And what level would nature be in? It's the sort of one or all being. It's, I'm looking at the scale now, and
and thinking it's certainly not courage or neutrality or reason, or it's more like peace or joy, you know, the way nature plays in the sun, and how it feels to walk, whether there's no one around or there will be one or two people, and unless they're on the phone arguing with someone, you can kind of, you know, you can kind of belong to this. You can kind of step into the parks, if it's a very big park, or nature reserves consciousness.
Mm.
You know, maybe that would be why it's people like it so much.
That kind of, you know, it makes sense almost on many levels, because on one level there's like the consciousness levels, and then there's, you know, what do trees give people or plants, or, you know, they give oxygen. So it kind of makes sense that we'd feel really good around them, you know, like sort of, at least, you know, well, yeah, it's sort of like it's nourishing us in a sense. And in a way, we're nourishing it back, because we feed it, I think it's carbon dioxide or not. This is not great, but I don't know this. But we feed it back something too.
you N person. I'm the same. I don't even go there. We feed it back.
Yeah.
You know what they're doing here? They're building this underground train station, and they are taking down trees that are hundreds of years old. It is so sad. They are moving many of them, but it's obvious to me, at least, that the entire area is in mourning, you know, the other trees. And I've seen that the really, really big ones are too big to be moved. Just imagine what they have seen, these 200-year-old huge trees. I hate it. I hate it. And then people say, in the name of, well, don't be sentimental, and you know, it's all in the name of progress. Well, that's not a valid argument, because if you say that I'm against progress just because I am sad when they kill these, take down these 200-year-old trees, I'll say that it's that you're against trees, you know, like they really, like, development and progress has nothing to do with these trees. I can be sad and for progress, you know.
Do you think the root of all injustice is not taking into account another's lived experience?
I'm trying to find an objection, but my whole being is just saying yes, 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 yes.
Yeah. I'm also trying to find an objection. Actually, this is funny. It's great. It's like it's interesting, because it's like, and maybe this is also what Hawkins is sort of at times referring to, and I think other people sometimes as well, of like, we can sort of, there's like blocks we can sort of, and I mean like almost like building blocks in our minds, I think, that we can sort of shift around and play around with what we're taking in and how we see it, and how we can kind of like I almost sometimes wonder if that's an aspect of philosophy, is sort of this like ways of organizing blocks in our minds, in a sense, to take in what we are experiencing. So sort of this like way of filtering in a way. But then there's also this other side of not having any blocks. And I wonder if that's partially like just suspension of disbelief to some degree, of just sort of letting, and you, I think you mentioned it earlier. Yeah. Just letting, letting what it is just kind of go through us. And then whatever happens after, I mean, it's sort of letting, it is letting go to some degree. It's letting go, or maybe not even letting go. Well, it is letting go, but it's sort of acknowledging. And I think this is sort of like a statistical truth in a sense as well, of like, we can never 100% know. Like, even in statistics, when they say this is proven, that's actually not 100% true. Nothing can ever be, I think, at least. And how, like, what I feel about statistics, I guess, that's a, nothing can ever, I mean, or at least maybe something can be 100% true, but I don't know if as humans we can, like, if we can say that, if that makes sense, or you know, I think, and maybe that's where it takes, this is sort of a circle in a way. I keep bringing up radical subjectivity because that's kind of where it takes us back to, of like, yes, that what is, you know, the only 100% that we have.
Yeah.
What is that? And that's what, in a way I feel like what is, part of the levels is like the 100% truth. Are we holding on to that? You know, and to what extent are we? And yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Those are the thoughts.
To what extent are we, what did you say about holding on to truth?
Oh yeah. Holding on to the radical subjectivity, I guess, the only truth that we're holding on to, in a sense, the only thing that we can maybe consider true is like our own experience in a way. And that everything else is at most like 99.99999, like even, you know, including our thoughts, including anything we read, including, you know, because even Hawkins, when he did the tests that he does to calibrate what level something is on, he did each chapter.
It's funny. It's funny that calibrate, and just this word, calibrate. It's funny.
Right?
Yeah.
It's like, it is kind of, it sounds very like, I don't know, it sounds kind of like, I'm just imagining being on a spaceship with Hawkins, and he's like, all right, I'm like, you know, calibrating these different, you know, buttons and everything, and I'm like, oh cool, calibrate, Hawkins, yeah.
Yeah, it's so funny that you have a scale of consciousness and then there's calibration and log. I mean, it's so concrete with the numbers and so infinitely mysterious with the with everything else, and then when you're looking at these arrows and the, oh, but never mind. Yes, it's yeah. Just buying this now. Yeah.
Well, where I'm kind of going with that in a funny way, actually, now that I think about it, is when he calibrated his chapters of the books, he, you know, in the book he wrote, none of them were like the 1000 level, or, you know, they were all sort of like in the 700 or 800s. And I thought that was, in some ways interesting, because it was like, pardon me, well, and I guess this is sort of like everything is 99.99% true in a way, where that's my, well, okay, I guess, does this, am I breaking the suspension and disbelief thing that we're going with if I, well, I guess, yeah, I might be. Because I was going to say that the calibration tool, or the way he does it, or, you know, I guess it's just any experiment or anything that a human could do, if humans are just sort of inherently fallible and imperfect, there's that 99.99. But I think, okay, you know, I don't know.
It's not breaking the suspension of disbelief, because for instance, when I've had I've held lectures about Myers-Briggs, and then there's always someone who says, I hate everything that has to do with these personality types things, because it'll just be I can't help it that I'm so bufflig, that I'm so that I've got my elbows out and I say the wrong thing. It's just the way I am, you know. I hate everything that has to do with personality, because it allows for people like that to never improve.
Mm.
So that would be breaking the suspension of disbelief, because you have presented an objection which has made you stop listening, you know. And the objection, if you had just waited a little bit, you would have heard that the first premise when it comes to personality is that everything that has to do with personality is can be affected by the will. You know, and here we have the will, which is a super important concept also in the scale of consciousness and in Dabrowski and in everywhere. So that would be to a person who says that just before my lecture, I say, because it happened, you know, I just said, just hang on, just wait. Well, you'll see that what you're saying has... It might apply to some other person's personality theory, but it certainly doesn't apply here. Just listen and hear me out, and you'll see, I'll say with a big smile. Yeah. But that's what I mean. So asking a question, saying like, what about this log and the numbers? Does it really work? I mean, that is just good philosophizing. Mm.
So there's sort of a difference between having maybe what I'm – the word that's kind of coming up is maybe even a defensive stance from the offset of bringing it up, sort of this closeness, versus kind of having an open feeling and just sort of being like, that kind of gives me a weird feel. What do you think? Like, is that a sort of...
or not being interested, like not having an interest. I have found a lot of people who need to cultivate their capacity to take an interest in things.
That's kind of part of the levels too, I think.
Should be.
In a way, I wonder if everything is connected to everything.
Yeah, but see here, level, willingness. See there? It's a 310.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you know, yeah, I was thinking, I don't know. Here's a thought that came up. Okay, mm-hmm. Earlier we were talking about, you know, wait, what would a tree be at, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm now wondering just, you know, what is nature's relationship with this scale? Mm-hmm. Because you're right, there are a few places on the scale where it wouldn't, you know, really make much sense for a tree, like reason, or courage or neutrality,
or anger.
Yeah, well, and here's where I'm going with this. I wonder is it possible that maybe it's like those sort of somewhat middle stages that only humans have to go through, like that one of reason, you know? But is it possible that there, you know, and I wonder if this is maybe, like, what, where is the earth at as a whole, you know?
There's an answer to this. So the book starts with, after the, in the introduction, I think, it talks about how it all started with the single cell amoebas, single cell animals. I'll just call it animals, right?
And then
I like that.
Yeah. And then human beings and what level you would be at when you see everyone as a possible enemy, and so forth, etc. And he writes explicitly that I can't find it right now, but he writes that the Earth as a whole, sort of the human civilizations as a whole, were on approximately 190 until 1983, when it was suddenly risen till something, and then in 2000 and whenever this book was written, 2000. Six. The world as a whole was at a level of 207, he said. This is obviously something that you can quite easily giggle at a little bit, you know, when because he's just stating these things, these years and these jumps and.
He's not telling us to like. He's just like, this is it.
Yeah.
And then I like, he's like, you believe it or not.
Yeah.
This is what like it. This is what I'm putting out here. And
yeah.
Oh, that's such a beautiful. There's something.
Totally liberating about it.
Yes. Yes. It's like, and I'm thinking about creativity, yeah. And maybe like the liberation of creativity and how, you know, there's things we think we shouldn't do or say or write or talk about. Mm. And then it's like, wait a minute though, you know, what, like, why, you know, or sort of like what, why be in the realm of shoulds?
it's because we have, at university, we are taught that this is not how to do it. But sometimes when you are stuck in that loop of how to do it-ness, you forget the big mission, which is the advancement of life and eudaimonia, this wonderful word that means flourishing. So each of us can flourish. And how to do that? Or, you know, we can allow ourselves to... I would say that this Hawkins guy he flourished, you know? And if I can say that about him, when he writes these quite preposterous propositions about how the world works, what do I mean when I say he flourished? What do I mean then? I look at the picture on the back and he looks like such a happy guy, you know? So fully content, he was fine with stuff, and, you know, I would like to feel that.
I really kind of enjoy this, like, humanness that you brought into that. Like, this very simple, basic idea of, don't you want to be happy? or, don't you want, like, where are you? Who are you? Are you okay? Yeah. How do you feel inside? Are you really okay in this world?
Like, you know, I'm the coach. The coach comes out. Yeah.
Yeah. It was sort of this core, this like the core of like, are you okay? Are we okay? Is the earth okay? Are the animals okay? Is the land okay? Is everyone okay? How does everyone feel? How are you all feeling? Like, and then everyone's, and then like 85% of the world's going to be like, we're below 200. It hurts here. It hurts. Mm-hmm. We are, you know, like this is not a good, this is not fun. And then it's like, okay, wait. Now I... And then me, who has a save the world complex, will be like, I will save you all 85% of the whole entire world, right now, today. Go, go, go. That's how. But I guess that's kind of, in a way, how, I don't know, there's this heart and humanness part of everything he's saying that's like, for me at least, maybe part of it at the core is this, like, are we all okay? And can we, like, can we, let's all be okay. Let's all, let's, like, yeah. Let's do this.
Yeah, we got let's this. All be okay.
I believe in us.
Yeah, I believe in us. And I feel that too. Let's all be okay. I believe in us. And I wanted to say about these 85% who say we're below 200, this is not fun. Also, if you're really a person who is below 200, say at anger, 150, and sort of pointing downwards in the contracting part of the scale, you know, the lower half that's contracting and the top half is expanding, and the lower half is force and the top half is power. Yeah. So if you're in that anger place and you are evaluating your life, so you already have, if you look at this scale, you will see, your view of life is that it's antagonistic, that God is a vengeful person. Your emotion, the emotion that you feel is hate, and the process that you're going through is aggression, or your process at the moment is aggressive. So how does this a person like that respond when you ask, how are you? Are you okay? You know, how does that person respond? We can have a mental image of what happens when you just picture someone who is this angry person who believes that, you know, you're going to, I have met a lot of people who are like that. I have met a lot of people who believe that, you know, you have to elbow your way through the world, and you know, nothing will ever go as planned. This is quite typical. I who am so nice, now again I'm in the hands of the evils of the world. It's all just a terrible battlefield. You know, nobody helps you. You know, you scream for help and nobody comes. This is a fact of life. You know these people? It's quite, and I have felt like that too. But I know I had a protest, an inner protest, saying no, I'm lying. I'm making this up to get through this. You know what I'm saying?
I sort of don't. Can you say that one more time?
If
you
don't mind. So the times that I have felt these sentences that I've used to sort of explain the world, how the world works, to myself, I've told myself that, you know, it's every man for himself. Nobody helps. It's not going to work out anyway. You always have to prepare for the worst. You know, and living in these worryful, I have a very, very vivid imagination. So living in these terrifying, horrible images in my head, just thinking it's, you know, like in a cramp holding on to life, you know, and feeling like, you know, hold on, otherwise I'm going to lose it, I'm going to completely lose it, I'll never be myself again, nothing will ever be good again. And having these long, long days of where everything is a struggle, you know, where you're always on the battlefield, you're always in the stand, and the jury is looking at you going, you, and with their long lists of things that you did or whatever.
I'm feeling that. It's like, what the words that I noticed that you kept using to describe this is always and never, and sort of these like very black and white statements. And you know, it's interesting because I think something that ties in with a lot of this is like trauma and everything like that, and sort of like what, and I almost feel like this is like it's scale of consciousness, but sometimes there's like a part of me that's like almost like not scale of trauma, right? But like maybe sort of what, but in some ways, you know, because I think a lot of in some ways, okay, one way that I'm looking at sort of the world is that if we think about it, like in the last 100 years, how many wars there were, and how many, like, what, you know, atrocities on massive scales happen, and how so many people were impacted, and, you know, they were impacted, and then their kids were impacted, you know, and it's sort of like, is this generational thing, you know, and it makes sense if people were sort of on this, like, fight or flight, sort of on survival mode of, and that part of trauma is thinking that, or sometimes being even in flashback states or like potentially emotional flashback states of this will never end, this sensation of this will sort of this eternal sense that certain difficult feelings will never end, you know, and so that kind of reminded me of this like never always idea and how that's all sort of tied in, I think, at least. I don't know.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. Whenever I hear anyone say never and always, it's always, it's this bell that tells you, okay, sorry. Watch. watch it. and see what the meaning is, like the umbrella that you can draw up and see what does this personal narrative mean, or like what it means, but what just listen to the personal narrative and listen for potential. Like, here's the coach again going, listen for the potential in the personal narrative to see where are the things that we can double check, so to say.
It's almost like, how is this person seeing themselves?
Yes, totally. That's precisely it. Yeah.
And how does that impact us? Dun, 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 dun.
and our position and the voice we use when we say Hineni, I am here. You know, who is doing that? Or maybe it's always just one voice. Maybe, I had a thought. Yes, you're not able to hear the question, where are you? In these lower places. You can only say Hineni when you're above something, right?
Miriam. Yes. Oh wow, that was great. This is wonderful. Like, yeah. It's almost like there's like blocks to it.
Yes.
Right? It's like trying, right? There's sort of this like wave towards it. And there's just things sort of in its way that won't let it get through. But it's always there in a sense.
Yes. That's true.
And I think that's the hope part, you know? The hope part is like, if you exist, then you can Hineni in a way.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Maybe like, I don't know. I guess I worry about saying ableist statements at points in time with this as well, where
what?
It's like,
what do you worry about? Ableist? What's that?
Like, sort of, like there's some, okay, there's, it's this term, and I know, okay, it's, from what I've seen, it's used more so in American culture from, I don't know, you know, I haven't seen it used that much yet, but I also, you know, I haven't necessarily studied or been so much around the world, so I don't know.
Have you watched a lot of Swedish TV lately?
Yeah. I have, yeah, maybe that, you know, watch TV in different languages and countries, but yeah, so I just, but it's sort of this term of like when people have disabilities and there are certain beliefs, cultural beliefs of even like productivity or how much, or sort of that a human's worth is inherently connected to what they can do, like, or how much they can work or how much money make, or
we have that too.
You know, what all these things that, you know, are sort of myths in a sense about human, you know, human worth and value, and then these myths or beliefs in society or stigmas and stereotypes, sort of that whole kind of box of things like that, impact people with disabilities or people in those circumstances that, you know, the whole, like, for example, like, you can do whatever you set your mind to, or follow your dreams, or sort of certain, like very large blanket statements that are kind of like, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, in a way, you know, or maybe it's this very individualistic, and maybe this is why it's coming from an individualistic culture that might be trying to sort of be like, hey, this is a little bit, this is a little bit too individualistic, maybe, I don't know, I don't know, but it's sort of like, I think that might be why it's even popped up, but yeah, I don't know, it's, so there's, and it's something I sort of was hesitant about with Hawkins beforehand, because it's, you know, but I think, he's pretty honest about, he says that most people won't, you know, change more than 5 points in their lifetime. And, that's kind of, you know, on one hand, it kind of solves this ableism issue in a sense, because it kind of is saying, well, you know, some, you know, this is sort of, the reality is that not everyone's like going to be necessarily like going through so much change in their life, or being in, or, you know, some people might suffer a lot in their lives, and that might be so much of their life, and then they die. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of a very painful truth in a way of how things have been in the past and maybe how things are right now. And, you know, so there's like this hope piece that's, you know, really beautiful. And then there's this sort of like realistic piece in some ways of, and then sort of this potential piece or possibility, a piece of possibilities and mystery. I don't know.
But what I want to be in the piece of possibility and mystery. Do you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. This is always, I run into this a lot. I'm so interested in personal development. And also, I don't know if the right word is mysticism, but kind of, I'm interested in the esoteric, bank of knowledge, if you can call it knowledge, about how the universe works. Mm-hmm. And you know, I love these things. I love them. I read books about it and, you know, YouTube clips, listen to people talking about it. And there's always, I always know that there are people starving. And if I have develop a theory like this, where do I put them? You know, this is a constant, it's much more than just a problem, because it feels like my entire, whatever theory I can build or whatever scraps of things I take from theories and build my own matrix with, it fails if I can't accommodate for the fact that so many people are
are dying in their first year, you know? What's the point with that? But I think for the purpose of this conversation and these recordings, I'm going to allow myself to be personal and, you know, to let these ideas be. They can be here if they can do anything, if they can do something or anything to someone I like, and people in close to me, or clients, or me, or, you know, they will have this value, even though they're not they are leaving things out. But you should always, as a good sort of someone who went to university, like I did, I have to acknowledge the things that I'm not dealing with, and the things that are outside the scope of this essay, blah, 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 blah. So that would be something.
It's sort of these, like, I don't know if they're not necessarily contradicting. I guess it's just holding this maybe both and in our hands, in a sense, of like, well, we are where we are, and we exist as what we exist as. So, and we came across what we came across in our lives, and this is what we're talking about now. Yeah. And it's very like, that's the, in a sense, the facts, right? That's what is, where it is right now. And another, on the other, you know, in the other hand, there's all humanity and all the other creatures and living beings and consciousness and energy and electrons and atoms and all these, like, everything in the, you know, that exists. And there is so much going on in a sense in their worlds, but also the truth of that there is pain and, you know, suffering, or people are, you know, we're not a world that's like, you know, the walk towards peace is happening, I think. But I don't think we've quite, like, in terms of, you know, I mean, one way we can look at the world and say everything is perfect in this moment right now, in a sense. And I say that in a very factual way, not saying perfect is necessarily meaning good or pleasurable or safe or happy or healthy, you know, like, perfect doesn't have to mean those things. And I don't think it does. But then on the other hand, you know, but then there's like, okay, so it just, there's this perfection. And then there's the, of course, again, the lived experiences and the radical subjectivity. And I think part of what Hawkins is sort of presenting is almost this way of empathy, in a sense, or a way of knowing how to, like, how other people in other stages really might be experiencing the world, both as a matter, it's both helpful in terms of, like, our own, you know, safety and well-being and understanding, and, you know, like, but then on the other hand, it's also like knowing and maybe even potentially being able to help more, but also sort of not having, I think that there's so much misunderstandings, I think, that happen below 200 with people. There's just these, and I think that's part of what, you know, there's constant misunderstandings or sort of like, misunderstandings, and of course there's people intentionally harming others, but I do think that there's a lot that's, you know, not intentional or sort of unconscious, and it's sort of like that phrase, hurt people hurt people. And so there's this sort of piece of, okay, well, if hurt people, well, I don't want to be hurt by hurt people.
Yeah.
You know, because I don't, you know, why I don't want to bring on unnecessary harm to myself. in a sense, or, you know, but then on the other hand, I'm like, okay, but also these people are hurt, and I'm not necessarily wanting to turn a blind eye either in this world to people that are hurt. And I think that's where the level 200 or the courage level comes in, because that's, I think, when people that are hurt are saying, okay, but I want help.
Yeah.
Like, I want to get out of this. And he even mentions in his book about AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and how, and I think a lot of rehabs in general or sort of, and I think to some degree, like, different organizations and stuff like that, and I know kind of ideas like that to a degree with coaching, where it's like, you know, it's like, do you want the help in a sense? And maybe that's where, like, sort of like unhealthy kind of, you know, like the victim perpetrator and savior kind of triangle that can happen with people. And maybe that's like, sort of plays a part in, you know, for example, like the savior being like, I'm going to help you, even though you're not like really asking for help, but like, or, you know, to some degree. And then each one sort of has their role that kind of keeps it spinning. And, or, you know, yeah. So I guess I'm thinking like this, once someone, yeah, it's sort of, there's this part of me that's like, let's just like, oh, and in that very ideal world, as an INFP who can be very idealistic, I'm like, let's get everyone to 200. Let's go. Because then it's like, then it can be, then I can share, then the people that are overflowing with love in a sense, or have like, or want to help, can help, right? Because it's this like opening to be able to help at 200. I think that's what, you know, and that's like, that's very, yeah, there's a sort of wisdom to knowing that, I guess, that I think he kind of passes on, of knowing that that is the level in which people will accept help, you know, and to sort of know what is out of our control in the world sometimes, in a sense.
I love that. I love that. At 200 is the level where people can accept help, and how we can use the scale of consciousness for empathy. Another thing I was thinking when I said you could also giggle at some of these things, it's also you can also imagine how someone at, say, the reason level, we'll look at the scale of consciousness, you know, and how someone at another level will look at it. It's the word that I want to end this with, because now I need to go now. I have baby duties, but I'm looking forward to. I'm going to read a bit more in this book, and then I want to. The follow-up one, I really hope that you want to do a follow-up call. I want to bring in the will, and we can put in Dabrowski and third factor.
Oh!
Yes. Because he also, I mean, on the last page, just before I put down the book, the necessary power resides in the non-linear quality of consciousness termed the will, which alone can open the gates to the power necessary to dissolve the ego's positionality. Oh, man, I want to talk about this now. Yeah.
Done. Yes. Done. Where are we going to be out when we talk about the mystery. Yeah.
All right, that's it for now, and tenderly we bid goodbye till next time. You've just heard Suspension of Disbelief, Exploring Hawkins Scale of Consciousness, a podcast episode from Philoprax, Göteborgs Filosofiska Praktik. My name is Miriam van der Falk, and I'm a philosophical coach, and I've been talking to Jay Mania, coordinator at Intergifted, artist and musician. And this conversation is a philosophical exploration of a system of thought. It's an hour's worth of dialogue doodling, and that's all. We suspended our disbelief on the hallway coat hooks and invited Hawkins' map of the scale of consciousness in for a chat in the bulging windowsill. Well, virtually. We wanted to listen politely and patiently, giving the benefit of the doubt, aiming for clarity of vision and steering clear of distortions. Sometimes one might come across spiritual ideas that enable abuse and shame the victim. But suspension of disbelief is something quite different, and we'd like to make that explicit here. And lovingly, we hope to inspire and engage.